You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer. Joining me today is our reporter Rachel Pels to talk to us about a new open access research plan that was recently launched by Science Europe. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Tell us about Plan S.
Yeah, it's an initiative that was announced by Science Europe in September to make all research paid for using public funding freely and immediately available through open access platforms. So far, 13 countries have signed up to it. Those are European countries and includes the UK's UKRI, UK Research and Innovation. Some details are yet to be finalised, mostly about how it will be implemented, but it's set to come into effect in January 2020.
This is a pretty massive achievement for the open access movement. Can you tell me, what does the S stand for in Plan S?
It's a good question. Robert Jansmits, who's the architect of Plan S and the European Commission's special envoy on open access, he's been asked this question quite a few times and has responded saying, you know, it could stand for science, it could stand for shocking. The way I think about it is, if you remember the 90s pop group S Club 7, mm-hmm. who were a big part of my life in the 90s, mm-hmm. they would say that the S stood for whatever you wanted it to. And I think it's the same with Plan S.
Okay, interesting choice of the 26 letters available for any sort of meaning to be projected on it. But okay, we'll roll with it.
Yeah.
Okay, so whenever they say that all publicly funded research must be published on an open access platform, what does that really mean? I mean, are hybrid models going to be included in this?
No, so it will effectively ban researchers from publishing their work if it is indeed published using publicly funded grants mm-hmm. in closed subscription journals. And that includes a lot of the big titles, influential titles under Nature, Science, Cell, because they are not fully open access journals or entities. Mm-hmm. Hybrid models don't really fit into it either. UKRI, for example, have been very outspoken in saying that hybrid models are not compliant with the plan, so it will no longer be considered an acceptable way of publishing. Their argument is that it's too expensive to run, because it typically requires someone to pay a publication fee. And they say it hasn't actually moved the transition to open access along as fast as they had hoped. That said, a transition phase will be implemented, so those journals which do operate hybrid models can have some time, presumably, to work out their next move.
Hmm. Because it has been quite sudden. I mean, maybe people would say that this has been a long time coming, but it does seem like this announcement was just kind of dropped like a Kanye album.
Yeah, it was a shock in that sense. It was just dropped on September 4th. There had been some discussion about it, but I think unless you were really tuned in to the open access debate, you wouldn't have known that this was going to be announced. But that said, it shouldn't have really been a surprise to people because it's been talked about for so long. It's inevitable. European open access advocates in particular have said, warned the big publishing companies, I guess, you need to sort your plan out now, because eventually there will come a time when it's enforced and you can no longer operate these expensive subscription models.
I mean, yeah, it is an issue that's been stewing for quite some time. Germany is in a fight with Elsevier right now about their own open access policies. What's been the response so far? Has this been widely accepted by open access advocates?
Yeah, it's been largely received well. I mean, obviously by those who are in favour of open access. The UK Society of College, National and Universities Libraries said that the shift was essential. That's been a sort of common theme from a lot of the large scholarly groups, including publishers. It seems to be the consensus that some kind of policy like this was needed to speed up the process of open access. Until now, there haven't been many hard incentives in place for researchers to publish in open access journals instead of the influential, high impact, if you like, titles. And likewise, not many incentives for those journals to reassess their subscription models and move themselves towards open access. Not everyone's happy with the plan, I should say. Obviously, some of the larger publishers have expressed their distaste for it. My favourite reaction came from Tom Reller, who's the vice president for global communications at Elsevier, when he was questioned on it by a Dutch newspaper. He said, "If you think information shouldn't cost anything, go to Wikipedia." And that's generally the vibe that we're getting from some of those big commercial publishers. But there are also, it's important to note that it's not a black and white situation. There's not a yes and a no camp. There are plenty of people who are card-carrying advocates of open access, but they're still worried about the details of the policy and what it could mean for smaller publishers.
Right. And I mean, it's not that the information is going to be completely free. It's just that readers aren't going to now have to pay to get that information. It's going to be on the back of the public funding bodies or even the authors themselves.
Exactly. I guess you could think about it as it's a redistribution of the money. The cost will be hopefully included within grants that you get from these public bodies. So, yeah, it's a flawed argument, the Wikipedia one.
Right, okay. Someone who has been quite a strong critic so far of Plan S is Lynn Camerlin, who, along with 9 other colleagues, wrote an open letter called A Response to Plan S from Academic Researchers, Unethical, Too Risky. And she's a professor of structural biology at Uppsala University. And I spoke with her earlier, and I began by asking her what some of the concerns were with Plan S that she raised in this open letter.
I need to make a very important clarification before I start, which is that the critique is not of open access. It's a critique of specifically Plan S, which is a very specific incarnation of open access. But obviously, open access, and I'm myself an open science and open data champion. And anyone who wants can check out my group website. I put my money where my mouth is, so I make everything really open. There are exceptions because of collaborations, but everything I'm in control of is fully open. So really, openness is a goal to strive for. So the thing with Plan S, if you look at the principles, as principles, these are wonderful, right? So basically, it's a great thing to aim for. But the problem is that we're not there yet. And by trying to do this in such a rush without thinking of the consequences, and specifically without what happens if the rest of the world doesn't join on, we go from having great principles to aspire to the risk of creating a very dystopian future. That may not happen, but it's a huge risk to take.
So when you say they're good, but we're not there yet, what are you looking at whenever you say that?
So, for example, when I'm looking at this, the funders will ensure jointly the establishment of robust criteria and requirements for services that compliant, high-quality, open-access journals must provide. And there's a comment about changing the valuation system and so on. And this is all great, but this is things that you need to put in place first, rather than jumping head first and trying to change everything and thinking, okay, we're going to change everything and worry about the consequences later. And so a big part of the problem, and so there was this report from the European Commission's Rewards Working Group, and there is a challenge at the moment that the reward system is at odds with open science practices. The thing is that if I disagree with the reward system, I'm a big proponent of DORA, but I remember also a great comment by a senior colleague who also disagrees strongly with the reward system, but he always feels he has this moral challenge. Because he himself is an incredibly successful researcher. He wants his students to tell them not to play this game. But if he does tell them not to play the game, then basically they're just out of the system. And so, I mean, it's very dangerous to try to uproot everything and then worry about changing the reward systems afterwards. And we have to actually change the reward systems.
And when you say reward systems, you're talking about reputation, impact factor, these kind of metrics that people use to rate the quality and worth of researchers?
Precisely. And I think a very big problem that doesn't actually come up enough in the discussion is that, what at the end of the day drives all of this problem. It's not even the metrics in and of themselves, which are what I consider symptomatic problems, but rather there's just a simple fact that the ratio of available resources to the number of people in the scholarly research landscape is not great. And as long as you have a problem where you have a much larger number of researchers than you have resources available to fund that research, the grant success rates get smaller and smaller, and the metrics by which the funding is allocated become more and more arbitrary. I mean, you're looking, for many funding agencies, you're looking at single-digit success rates. And I mean, once you get into single digits, it's very hard to have an objective, meaningful metric that you're really judging the best proposals if you have a single-digit success rate.
That reminds me of one of the, what I thought was a crux of your argument in the open letter that was talking about how Plan S violates academic freedom. Can you run us through that argument?
So I think there are, as pointed out by my colleague Britt Holbrook, who's an ethicist and was a co-author on this, there are two aspects of this. One of them is the issue of basically, so the academic freedom means different things. Since we wrote this piece, a lot of people have come out and pointed this out. So, for example, the U.S. definition of academic freedom is much more rigorous than the European definition, and the European definition depends also on which European country. So, for example, there have been at the national level, funding agencies have expressed concerns about the academic freedom issue, most notably a spokesperson for the German DFG, where they were talking about how they mandate open access, but they want authors to have the freedom of choice as to how they make things open access. So I think if we were talking about a mandate to make things open access, that in itself would not be by any means a violation of academic freedom. But the thing is that Plan S, by mandating exactly how, not just that, but the precise shape of how this should be made open access, and it ignores the much bigger landscape of the different ways you can make your work open, that's a problem. There's another aspect of this, which is that because it severely restricts where researchers can publish, it ends up being not just a restriction on how we can disseminate our own individual research, but it also becomes a restriction on who's willing to collaborate with us. Because if you're from a non-Plan S funded situation, so you may have completely different ideas about where you want to publish. And if you're not the best person in the world at what you do and have a very niche expertise, then likely they can find someone else for their collaboration who could do the same thing without restricting their choice of how to publish. So it doesn't just become about how can you disseminate your research, but it also becomes the limitations on freedom of who's willing to collaborate with you.
And you mentioned it briefly there, but you also talk about creating social inequality for early career researchers. And I think that's kind of what you're saying, is if you aren't a researcher that has a lot of influence or clout, then you might be forced to go along with things that go against Plan S or go along with Plan S, even though that might not be what's best for your personal career.
It's not just that. So this is part of it. But my bigger concern is that if you read the principles, so the principles are very careful in not naming a specific form of open access. But for me, it's very hard to read these principles as anything other than a mandate for pay to publish. I mean, there's discussions about APC and so forth. The problem is that when you move into gold system, then literally all you're doing is you're taking readership costs and you're putting them as publication costs. And that creates a really big problem because, I mean, there are so many issues here. Think about literature and this idea of vanity publishing. It's always a problem when people are paying to disseminate their work. But in addition to that, in a gold landscape, which I'm deeply critical of, you create a situation where you have to be fairly well-funded, and how well-funded you are, this will dictate where you get to publish your research. And then that creates a vicious cycle because, while, again, I personally am a strong supporter of DORA and I implement this in my own evaluation and so on, but the reality is that the bigger landscape, going back to this problem with single-digit grant success rates, that people are swayed by where you've published. And the open access landscape is also stratified. So then you get this perverted situation where essentially people that already have lots of resources can continue to publish in glossy open access magazines. And so you literally just take all the problems that we're critical about in the current publishing model, and you just transpose them on top of the open access publishing model with the added factor that on top of all the previous problems we had, you now have to have lots of money to be able to get in as well. And so I really don't want to see a model in which barriers to read become changed to barriers to publish, specifically because another point I just wanted to make. So one of the big concerns about preprints is that they're not peer-reviewed. But I was really pleasantly surprised. I was looking, for example, we were looking at submitting a paper to a high-profile American Chemical Society journal, And chemistry has been notoriously resilient to preprints and just openness, just because we're much more conservative bunch of traditionalists. But so preprints are really taking off in chemistry. And where I was pleasantly surprised was the fact that this journal, which is a quite high-profile chemistry journal, they not only allow you to deposit preprints, but they allow you to revise the preprint after every round of peer review, and you can actually update the preprint up until the moment the decision letter is issued. So at that point, arguments about freedom and access to information become very limited because the preprint server has a very open license. You can choose your license on these preprint servers. So you could just put the final peer-reviewed manuscript with no embargo in a preprint server under very open license and then publish it in, say, a society journal.
Hmm.
And this mechanism is already in place. But this, as written, the 10 principles right now, my interpretation would be that this would not be compliant.
Mm.
And so that then creates a very strange situation. Why are we trying to push to a model where publishing will cost a large amount of money for individual researchers instead of encouraging different ways where we can actually make access to information open without creating a whole new set of problems that limits access of researchers to publishing?
In your letter, you also provide some alternatives that you think would be better for open access, but also an improvement on Plan S. Can you run me through a few of those?
So there are, for example, if you look at PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the U.S., this is a delayed open access journal. So basically, this is actually in a way is very convenient because the papers become automatically open access after 6 months. The author doesn't even have to do anything. So that's really great because you don't have to worry about people missing to put things in a repository and so on. So if you could combine that with a preprint, if you basically have a scenario where you can update the preprint up until the very last referee report, so the final version that you submit to the journal up until the decision letter, then the information is out there immediately. And then, yes, the journal is putting a quality stamp and they're putting typesetting and various still things that the journal are doing, but the actual information was available freely. And then if it automatically becomes open after 6 months,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that would just, in a nutshell, solve the problem. And we are moving towards much greater uptake of preprints. I really think that green is the way forward. So preprints that can be updated up until the decision letter, and then everything at the end is made open. On, we'd say an embargo, but it doesn't matter that much if the final accepted manuscript is anyhow in the preprint server. Because that becomes a question then of what are you willing to pay for a template. So that would be the first solution. The other solution, and this is a much more challenging solution because it requires people to take responsibility. And the solution would be that there are an increasing number of diamond journals. So these are free for reader, free for author. But, of course, the money has to come from somewhere. So successful diamond journals are either funded by, say, a foundation, so they have big support from an external patron, and it's important that these are ethical external support sources. Or, for example, say their family of journals has a big subscription base, and then they use the revenue of the nonprofit funding agency to fund their platinum journals. So, for example, a very brave move, rather than talking about caps for APCs, would have been that we will sponsor reputable scholarly publishers from, say, scholarly societies. So we will use these funds to make them diamonds compatible. So there were so many ways this could have been done, and I really wish that it wasn't such a narrow and restrictive definition of what open access should look like, but rather actually encouraged a much broader open access ecosystem, one in which scientists were brought on board.
But how are you feeling now? We've already got 13 national funding organizations are signed up to Plan S. Do you think there's anything to be done?
I think, effectively, researchers at the individual level have been left out of the debate in a very massive way. So on the 4th of September, when this news came out, I was at a conference, and literally no one I spoke to had heard or had any inclination of what was going to happen. And I think at this particular moment as we speak, not enough researchers know what's happening. I think researchers really need to speak up and take responsibility here. This is absolutely important, because if we don't speak up, then effectively we can't complain that decisions were made without us. From my personal level, I still continue to strive for open science, not just open access, because there are other aspects, data and so on as well, and it's something that I strongly believe in. But I also believe that it has to be done in a sustainable way that doesn't create barriers to publish rather than barriers to reading. And it has to be done in a fair way that doesn't exclude people from the scholarly communication endeavor.
And that was Lynn Kamerlin, a professor of structural biology at Uppsala University. You've reported quite extensively on Plan S, Rachel, but the most recent story you've published is looking at how this will affect societies?
Learned and professional societies. They're quite an interesting case. Essentially, it sounds like it's quite bad news, especially for smaller societies who publish their own journals. One of the key aspects of Plan S is that article processing charges, which are set out by publishers, will be capped, though nobody knows what that limit will be yet.
One of the details that's still waiting to be...
still waiting to be announced. Mm. But if it's restrictive, if it's a very low cap, some of these organisations which publish subscription journals who say that they really rely on that on that fee for their income, if they lose that income, effectively their society could close. So I spoke to Niamh O'Connor, who's treasurer of the UK's Association of Learned and Professional Society Publishers. And she said that really the group's members are in favour of Plan S, that they are open access advocates on the whole, but it means they're having to face something of an existential crisis. One of the arguments being raised, and by some of those society members as well, is that if your journal or indeed your society can't function effectively and be solvent in an open science world, then maybe you don't have the right to exist after all.
Harsh.
I know. So just to give you an idea of what these particular concerns are from these smaller publishers, i.e. society publishers, I've got a few, I was sent a few anonymous responses from some members of the ALPSP. One that's particularly interesting is from someone who's an executive director of a learned society, and they say, "This scares me to death. Half of our revenue comes from our three journals. That revenue subsidises all our other programmes, membership, certification, conference and online learning. We've worked very hard over the past 10 years to try and make all these programmes self-funded, but have not been able to do so." So then it goes on to say, "I think if Europe goes the way of this Plan S, which it will only be a matter of a year or two before we are forced to cease operations." So one of the points that society members raise is that they get this revenue from the journals that they publish, and that money goes towards charitable or outreach programs, so scholarships, events and conferences and things like that, and their argument is, well, we won't be able to do that anymore, and that's a loss for the community. To counteract that argument, I have spoken to a couple of people, Stephen Eaglen, who is from the University of Cambridge. He pointed out that actually the money that will be lost, it won't be lost to the scholarly world. It will just stay with the universities who would have subscribed to that journal. Mm. The short answer being the universities can still fund those charitable outreach programs. So it's not a loss to the whole community.
And support the fields that those societies serve.
Presumably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting. So it sounds like it's, among other things, just presenting a major shift in the funding model for higher education research.
Yeah, it's about just reorganising that, where that money goes to. Thinking about if societies disappear, then where will those journals go to? Who will publish them, look after them? Mm-hmm. Will they cease to exist? Is that okay? It raises lots of other questions, I think.
Okay, so we've got a little under 18 months until Plan S is supposed to be completely implemented in January 2020. So what's going to happen between now and then?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but the details of the plan are basically coming together. So promises, Robert Jan Smits. I spoke to him for a piece recently, and he said the devil is in the detail. There's a Plan S implementation task force that's been set up, and he says that they'll deliver by the end of the year. he also said that he was very wary of rushing into the details of the plan because he didn't want to end up regretting decisions that had been made or thinking they were out of date further down the line. He's also been to the US to talk to policymakers there who were very excited about the prospect of a similar policy, if not Plan S. He says he has eyes on Japan, India, South Africa and China. So I think watch this space, basically.
Yeah, that's quite interesting because that was one of the criticisms that Lynn Kamerlin brought up, was that if this is just a Europe-only policy, then that's really going to limit the global connections that European researchers can make with other researchers in other countries who might not want to publish their research in only an open access journal.
Yeah, that's it's a good point. It's worth mentioning as well, US funders have their own policies on publishing open access papers with public funding. So it's not, although there might be some hiccups and it might be difficult to work out, internationally, what does this mean for sort of international research and collaboration? But the two, the US certainly and the European model are not incompatible.
Thanks so much for explaining that, Rachel. We look forward to seeing more as things develop on timeshighereducation.com, where all of your stories are published.
Yes.
If you've got any comments or questions for the podcast or about Plan S, you can get in touch, sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.